One thing that really scares me and disempowers me a lot is when I'm hearing, I'm now the conferences, not the small scale farming conferences, but the conferences where I'm sitting at for policy, everything's about the future of farming being hydroponic towers, mechanized. It feels that we're really backward with these small scale farms, like, and having lights now to grow in the winter, but these low energy LED lights, technology is always pushing to be part of this. And I just don't know if I'll be able to cope with, I think I'm going to just end up being an old kind of style farmer. Because it's going pretty fast with technology, and I'm not sharing that optimism for having technology clean my beds, you know.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm Lindley Dixon, co-director of the Real Organic Project. We're a grassroots farmer-led movement with an add-on organic food label to distinguish organic crops grown in healthy soils and organic livestock raised on well-managed pasture. You just heard from J.M. Fortier, a best-selling author and farmer who has educated hundreds of thousands of small-scale farmers and home gardeners on human-scaled market farming techniques. He and his team at the Market Gardener Institute have had an incredible reach beyond his books. They offer online classes, a reality television show in their home province of Quebec, and this week, they're launching a new podcast that Dave will be interviewed for as well. JM will be featured in the second session of our annual symposium, which will air on April 7th from 3 to 5 Eastern. We hope you'll join us in the discussions after the session. You can find out all the details by visiting the main menu of our website, realorganicproject.org.
Welcome to the Real Organic Podcast. I'm talking today with J.M. Fortier. J.M., so good to see you again.
Hey, happy to have you here, Dave.
Yeah.
Thank you for the drive, for driving here.
Yeah, it's great. Not that far. Not that far. So here we are in one of your beautiful greenhouses, mm-hmm. and you're growing all this great food for a new restaurant and inn that is a new adventure for you.
Yeah, I started last year. This is about 5 minutes from my home farm. And that for 7 years I was running FQT Farm, the training farm, where you were last time that we did this. And I'm still a part of that, but I wanted to come back home. It was an hour commute to the other farm that I would do, twice a day. So coming back, and then I tried to come back to my home farm, but my wife said, you know what, I kind of like it now that I'm running the show. And I really felt that, okay, she's running the show. And, I saw this place here, and it had been for on sales for 2 years, and it's a landmark of the area, the old mill. The site and the building is 1849. And I've been driving here for many years, and I was seeing this big field just by the restaurant, and I was like, wow, that would be a great farm to table. We could do a market garden there. And eventually it became my new project.
Yeah.
And now almost a year and a half later, the restaurant's been open since March. We've had clients, throughout the whole season. It's been really a good response. People are excited. It's 100% local. So all the ingredients that we cook come from the local area here. There's a few exceptions. All the veggies come from the garden. I grow them. Local wines, local everything, local meats.
Great.
And so it's a real, genuine farm to table. And for me also, it's a space where I can connect with people that come and visit the garden, visit the winter greenhouse. I educate them on that. And I've really taken on a role here in Quebec to talk about food sovereignty and trying to express this idea that food sovereignty doesn't involve high-end technology in the winter. It involves, perhaps low-tech greenhouses, and that you can really feed, you can feed your house, feed the nation, the province of Quebec, with local food year-round.
Yes.
And so that's really what the project that I'm working on with this. And I'm also enjoying, you know, fine dining in the garden and all of that.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. You know, I want to talk a little bit about, I find your path fascinating because you started as a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you're still a farmer, but mm-hmm. you've clearly, on a pretty big way, become an educator.
Yeah.
And an activist, I would say a political activist.
Yep.
That is all based on the farming.
Yep.
So let
thank you for recognizing that.
Yeah.
Because that's really what I'm all about.
And you know, there are a lot of great educators who actually aren't so strong on farming.
Mm.
You know, some they have good intentions, but they don't really maybe understand it. You really understand it. And I also believe, and I'll say this, that I think you're one of the most effective educators that I know of.
Mm.
And that you have
thank you.
You have really helped many, many hundreds, if not thousands, and I suspect thousands of people to become better farmers through your efforts. And that's like Eliot, you have cast a big shadow in a shadow in which people have been protected from the sun and learned how to grow things and learned how to make a living.
Yeah.
So yes, gardeners, but also farmers.
Yeah. Well, but Eliot paved the way in many ways because I really took his playbook for my farm, and then, you know, I worked on it, and then eventually came up with different thing. And I think one of the big differences earlier on also is that we were really land constrained. We had 2 acres. That was it. So we needed to make it work for that 2 acres. And then another thing that you would understand that happened is that really early on in our farming career, we had some professional greenhouse growers come to our farm and teach us how to grow professionally in our greenhouses.
Mm.
And then that was one way that we got just more production out of the same small space. We just kind of doubled, tripled the quantity of vegetables that we were growing in our greenhouses. So that had a huge impact on our trajectory and on our bottom line.
Were they consultants, Jan?
Yeah, they were consultant. And we were the first one here in Quebec from the small farm movement to have them come. And I think they took us as a pet project, because obviously you would know this. They came into our greenhouses and they were like, okay, well, you know, you have a nice greenhouse, you have a heating system, we can do something here, you know, I'll teach you how.
Yeah.
You know, grafting the plants, growing on 2 or 3 liters, really going with much more density, learning how to prune and trim and, you know, really adjust the plant. So it took us 2 years to really get better at it.
Yeah.
And then we would report to other growers in our winter conferences. And then eventually, you know, it spread.
It spread.
Yeah. And then these consultants started to do work with other farms. And now, you know, there's a pretty high level of competency here in Quebec with greenhouse production.
There's a thing that I have seen, which is that there is a mindset. It's not just about technique. It's not just about, you know, run this temperature and this humidity and this spacing. But there's a kind of thinking, and we started on our own, just like everybody in a hoop house, or actually pre-hoop house, in a 2x6 house. and you know, we were building them with gussets and
wooden
houses. Yeah. Our first
that's
ones,
prehistory.
Our first one was 2x4.
Yeah.
And we designed that with horrible. And then we started to use a design from University of Connecticut and 2x6 and, prehistory, but it all worked. It blocked a lot more light than the hoops, and it was heavier, but it was actually not that, it was not hard to build a greenhouse.
Yeah.
The miracle drug was the plastic coating, which made it very easy. You didn't need to build something strong enough to hold glass and all that.
Yeah.
But very soon in there, we started working with a Dutch consultant.
Mm.
And we were just lucky that we stumbled on this guy, and he didn't know anything about organic.
Yeah.
But he did know a great deal about greenhouses and tomatoes and climate and how to make climate and what that meant. And, you know, it took years of studying with him. He came every 3 weeks for years.
Wow.
And we ended up learning a great deal. And I'm on my second Dutch consultant, and he doesn't come as often, but you know, when he's there, when we need him, he's there. And part of what I see that they taught was a way of thinking about problems. Mm-hmm. And I think you have a lot of, you also, in your education and in your own development, you've developed a way of thinking.
Yes.
Right? About systems.
Yeah. Yeah, right? Systemizing. I've always had that in me. My wife really has the green thumb, for sure, more than me. She spends a lot of time with the plants. And that also is part of it, you know, intuition and having the acumen of just plants. But for me, it's systems. It's organizing labor to be efficient. It's this design. Like, a big part of my learning was also studying permaculture really, really earlier on. I'm reading a lot of Bill Mollison work. He was talking about zone and planning and how to set up things with regards to how many times they're visited per day and limiting, you know, foot traffic, foot circulation on the farm. I was reading about that. And then there was also another moment where I went to Cuba and we saw farms that were run without tractors. But these were like acres and acres of permanent raised beds. And so all these things for me, they had a big impact on my bottom line and on my farm and on my farming life. And so soon enough, when I wrote my book, I was just wanting to kind of give back the way I got kind of, you know, education was the way we got to be successful growers by learning from others. So I was like, I want to give back. And then my book became something really a powerful book for many because it was a primer, but it was also, I think it was giving the hope that you can have a small farm and still be, you know, profitable and have a life. And you can. And so that's kind of how all of this evolved. And you saw the FQT farm.
Yeah.
So the FQT farm there, what is amazing is that there I was being paid. And I was paid to develop the farm so that it was ever more efficient.
The farm was a nonprofit.
Yeah.
Intended to educate young people about how to do this successfully and make a living.
Yes. So that's the goal of the farm. That's one of the goal of the farm. And then we do this by having them for 2 years. And they're working, you know, like if it's their own farm. They're working big days, big weeks, big years. And like for me, the objective is like, I'll train you so that when you're on your own farm, you know the rough cuts. It's like, this is real. And you've learned how to be in your fifth gear because I'm bringing you there. So when you're on your own farm, you know how to operate in fifth gear. But doing that work, I was also shadowing a lot of the things that we were doing, trying to see where improvement could be done. And we filmed that over 4 years, and that became the masterclass. That's the online course that I teach now. And the masterclass, when we developed it, you know, I had no idea what it would become. You know, we filmed it for 3 years and then we did another year. But when we launched it overnight, there was, I think it was 460 people that took the class. And so that kind of propelled another project. Now we have that. And now, you know, I was telling you there's more than 4,000 people in the class in 91 countries. And so it seems like, yes, like I start things, but they grow on themselves. And the book, you know, the Market Gardener has a life of its own. Like I just don't manage it anymore. It's just traveling on its own.
Can I ask a couple questions about that? First of all, the book, it sold a lot of copies, right?
Yeah, it's more than 250,000.
250,000 people who bought that book.
Yeah, it's in 10 languages.
And so that has touched a lot of people, many, many of whom are commercial growers.
Yeah.
And some who are really good home gardeners, homesteaders.
Yeah.
Okay. When you talked about the masterclass having 4,000 students, can you talk a little bit about how it's not that they're all 4,000 are taking the masterclass at this moment? They're part of an online community.
Yeah. So the way we've set up, so now we've evolved it into a community, And it's run by the Market Gardener Institute. So now there's people, there's staff, that their role is to organize how to the community operates. And a big part of it is when you get into the masterclass, it's an open library. So it's not, it's a self-directed course. It's, you're not with me at specific points. Like it's all video based. And then you have the crop itineraries for all the vegetables the way I do them. And then I explain to you why what I do is what I do. And then I'm inviting you to kind of follow in that footsteps. So people get into the class, they have all of that knowledge, how to grow the crops. But what we're doing now is also troubleshooting sessions. I mean, we're creating sessions where people troubleshoot together, and we're trying to bring new ways of helping growers, because not everyone has access to good education, a good extension agent, a good agronomist, consulting. You know, not everyone has that. So trying to have the community help one another. And so that's really, really interesting. And that's not something that I had foreseen. And now that it's in 90 countries, we're getting people from different places connecting together. It's very cultural.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And I feel very excited about this. And then to bring it back to here, it's also the headquarter of all these people that are working within the masterclass. So now we staff 8 people full time.
So for the masterclass community.
Yeah, for that, just in itself. And then we're also working on new content. We also have a technical person in-house, so people can kind of have, you know, professional advice about some growing concerns. And for me, I've always thought that if we want to influence the next generation of growers, in my opinion, like, the better way is to help them become better growers. That's it. Because the learning curve to become a good grower is so steep. It takes so many years of trials and errors. And then, you know, you do a winter greenhouse once and you're off by 3 weeks. And then that year is, and then you need to wait a full year to do it again. Yeah. But what if we could take like 6-7 years and bring it down to 2 or 3?
Yeah.
And that's the message that we're getting. Like, people take the class, they follow what we're doing, and then they get successful after 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
It took me 7 or 8.
My first year was a total disaster in a greenhouse. Right. So, and I even had some pretty good technical advice from the EU, from the Europe. Yeah. But yeah, that it's a big process.
And we were talking about this, you and I. It's like, I see that for me is the cornerstone, or one of the pillars that we need to build on if we're going to bring another generation of organic growers to become more, you know, influential and just have more of them out there. They need to learn how to be growers.
Yeah.
They need other stuff. You know, they need to be good at marketing, accounting. We talked about social justice. These are all important things in our community, but the growing part, becoming a good grower and learning how to do all these different things, for me, that's what I teach.
Yeah.
The rest is, you know, that's my bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, we're building a culture of organic farming out of essentially nothing. Not true. There's a long history of it. And yet at the same time, much of that history has been blown away by the chemical revolution. Yeah. And so these are, even if it's not a first generation farmer, if they usually grew up on a chemical farm and they're trying to figure out, well, how do I do this differently, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it really is something that requires a lot of helping each other. One of the things I learned from my Dutch consultant is that in Holland, in a greenhouse, every grower is part of a growing group.
Mm.
So they meet.
And they troubleshoot.
Every 2 weeks,
yeah,
they go to somebody's greenhouse. There'll be like 5 of them.
Yeah.
And they go to, then the next week or two, they go to a different greenhouse and they compare their growing notes and talk about their settings and their computer and their problems. And we don't really have that model.
But we should.
We should.
We should, because that's how I learned. Like, I would visit farms. I, you know, that's another thing. I felt very privileged because I because of my book and because of other things, my curiosity perhaps, and I speak French. So I went to France many times and I would visit farms where the level of competency was high, super high. And then you come back and you're like, okay, I know I've seen this and I can tell you how to do this. And I practice it too. So I'm not just kind of winging off things that I've seen. Like, this is something that I see, I incorporate it, I practice it, I test, I trial it, and then I pass it on. But yeah, that's, for me, is like, that's the culture of agriculture, is also geeking out on, you know, crop varieties and spacing and temperature settings and planting dates and successions and tricks at farmer's market. And, you know, all of this for me is the core of what we do.
Yeah.
It's our trade.
Yeah.
And then the rest, all the political aspects of small-scale farming, which for me are very important, they're secondary.
Yeah. I mean,
because at one point, our job is to feed our community. That's really what this is all about. So that's really important that we learn how to do it well.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to go there, actually.
Yeah.
But first, I just want to talk a little bit about the education, because it's such a key part of what you're doing, and it's working. I mean, comparing the masterclass, that which is a series of virtual classes,
yeah,
right? And you taught me once that they should be very short, because you give somebody a 40-minute lecture, you lost them on minute seven.
For sure.
Right? So very short, digestible bits, yeah. And this is this. And the more complicated it is, the shorter it is.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
So true. Comparing that to the book, Your First Labor of Love,
yep.
That reached by numbers a greater number, how do you feel the impact is in terms of learning with these two different, quite different mediums?
Well, you know, I think, so the book, you know, is $30. And the masterclass is like 2,000 US. So it's very different. It's a very different product. The book is a primer. The masterclass is a masterclass. It's like for professional growers, and we're going into the details. I think the book, what was really a success about it is like people would read it from coast to coast and they got it. They got the big picture. They got that it was possible to farm on a few acres. And they were explained a little bit of the key principles of how to do it. And that was like planting the seed in their mind that this is possible. And that's what I've heard. Like, a lot of growers that I meet, they'll tell me, I've read your book and it was what influenced me to start farming. That's what I've heard, you know, many, many times over. So that was more of a primer, an introduction to market gardening. And then at one point, it's like I was teaching that this was possible, but I was also teaching that how to take it to the next level. That's what I was doing at FQT Farm. And I felt that I wanted to also share that. And so there's levels. And I don't know if it was like you for that, but like when I was reading Elliot Coleman's book in my first years, every winter I would reread it and I would understand new passage. Like there's things that I had read before but I didn't relate to because I wasn't there yet. But now I was reading them, I was understanding that passage. And I was understanding, now I was getting this passage because I had more experience. And so for me, there's kind of levels. You know, you're starting in farming, everything's new. Then you become an intermediate grower. Then you become a professional grower. And then there's higher educational. I'm still learning a lot.
Sure.
You know?
Always.
Always. And putting things in practices, smaller details. And for me, my North Star, Dave, is always efficiency. That's really what my mind works at, is like how to shave time here, how to cut down this, how to make sure that everything's tight, organized. And I wanted to be there early on because I wanted to finish the day at 5 or 5:30.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be with the kids and I wanted to do other stuff. And I still think today that that's really important.
Yeah.
Efficiency is like the driving factor of what you should be doing on your farm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting. I it's not quite what I think about, but I almost take it for granted, maybe, so I don't even think about
it. Yeah, because you're well-structured, you're well-organized, your farm's been, you know, the procedures have been well laid out.
It's very mature
farm. If you meet young growers today, they don't have procedures.
Yeah.
Some of them have structure, some of them have good designs, but when I started, you didn't have good designs. Beds weren't standardized, beds were permanent. I had never met a farm that was on a permanent bed system before we did, before I went to Cuba. Saves so much time. You know, there's been a big evolution over the last 20 years, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of hopeful, because what I see now is like people starting on the, on something that's a strong foundation.
Okay.
Yeah, I see that.
I see. So one more thing before we go on to that political and marketing and that world is you also basically ran an apprenticeship program at FQT.
Yeah. Ferme quatre temps in French. It's hard for everyone to say. So
it's hard for me to say.
FQT farm, you can look it up, but it's Ferme quatre temps.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Four season farm.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Four times.
Four times.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and you had an apprenticeship program. How many people would be on that in 1 year? How many?
Ten.
Ten.
And it's still running today.
It's still
running. It's just like one of my apprentices is now the teacher. She's the director. She's the woman that I wrote this winter farming handbook with. But it's 2 years. And so the way it works is that you come for a first year and you're learning the ropes and you're doing a full season and you're under the guidance of the second year co-workers.
Yeah, yeah.
So the second years, they all have a specific role and responsibility. One person's in charge of the nursery. One other person's in charge of the greenhouses. One other person's in charge of, you know, bed prep and implantation, you know, doing the seedlings, and one other person's in charge of harvest. And so the way that works is that these when that's your responsibility, you have the whole crew with you during that time. So when we're doing nursery work, everyone works for Dave because Dave's in charge in the nursery. The next day we're in the greenhouse, Dave works for Catherine because Catherine is the manager of that. And so this way, they're all learning how to manage a lot of people when it's their time.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, absolutely.
And then the second year, they're in charge of you know, managing the first year, explaining to them how to do things, what to do, setting the pace, setting the tempo, just like answering questions. And then I would help the second year become good managers, because there's, you know, learning how to manage is also another milestone.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of things to learn. There's a lot of ways to go about it. So I would spend time with the second years working with them. So I was actually working with four people.
Yeah.
And then they were working with the group.
So there'd be like four second years and six first years?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then we'd flip again. We would usually lose one or two.
Yeah.
And then we'd have, you know, three or four coming for a second year. And then after 2 years on that farm, man, these people are high level growers. Like, they've touched a lot of things. They've gone through the motions. You know, this farm, Dave, is like $700,000 of produce in a given year. And there's 10 of us.
Yes.
11 plus me. Big markets is 20,000 and no tractor. So this is high volume of, it's 400 bunches of carrots, it's 400 bunches of beets, it's, you know, 500 pounds of tomatoes.
And how many graduates have started their own farm?
So the FQT farm, I started it, founded it in 2015. It was, the first year was just a setup. And then, so it's been running for almost 7 years. It's going to be the seventh year now. We've had more than 40 people that have started their own projects.
Great.
Including some that have trained others. Right. And the founder, the philanthropist that is behind it, his goal was to get 100 new farms in 10 years. and we're off a little bit.
But doing pretty well.
Yeah, I think it has impact.
Yeah.
You know, I think it has impact.
So, and then the masterclass, again, these different ways of touching people and seeing how they change. And what's fascinating is Lindley has told me when she's going around, and she doesn't do it so much now, but she was actually going out and inspecting the farms in the beginning of the Real Organic Project. And she said, well, I always know when I walk onto a JM farm. It's like, oh, you've done the master class.
Yeah.
You know, there it is. And actually, Emily Oakley said the same thing about Lindley's greenhouse. She walked on and said, oh, this is a long wind greenhouse, which it was.
Yeah.
You know, she built one based on our ideas. And they're always well run. They always work.
Yeah.
The JM farms work.
Yeah.
And Davey Miskell just told me about one today. He said, oh yeah, well, you know, they're from that model and they do a really good job in their first year farm and they're doing a great job. So
but that you know that touches
of course.
That touches home.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Mm. All right. So you're changing the world in a pretty big way for a farmer, and I understand that you're part of a team.
Yeah.
And you know, the masterclass is not a one person operation. No. I completely understand.
My wife also has been enduring me all these years.
I understand.
You know, she's put up with a lot of different things over the years.
Yeah.
It's definitely it's not a one man gig. For sure.
Yeah, and nothing ever is.
Yeah.
We're always we're always interconnected. So, can we talk a little bit about why you do what you do, and you know what that means to you? What's the world you dream of?
Yeah. The why is very present in me. Like I often ask myself, you know, I always do a check-in and. There's always a good reason why I do what I do, and I think that propels me. Like, you know, I was saying to you that our farm was having a success early on, and I was seeing other farms not having that success in my community, in my farming community. So I was like, okay, well, I think I have something to offer there, and that was one of my motivation for my first book. And then what happened is that over the years, we trained a lot of people on our farm. And they started farms here. And then what we saw was that when we got here in this community, there was one or other organic farm. Now there's about 35. You know, we're opening this farm-to-table restaurant, but there's like three cafes, all locally sourcing everything that have opened over the years. We have Wednesday night farmer night here in Frelisburg. Yeah, these are small towns, these small villages. And so I've seen the impact of multiplying the number of small farms in our community. It's probably one of the biggest employee in the whole area, all these farms, with the microbreweries and the vineyards. So for me, it's like I see that. And I feel that this has the capability to really change the cultural landscape everywhere. Because small farms that are locally servicing to the community, food grown with care by people who care, and I've asked Elliot if I could use that from him, because that was Elliot's vision. Like, I believe this changes the world, and I've seen it here. So that's the message that I try to bring when I travel and I go to other places where this is not there yet. And I tell them, it's not there yet, but if you do it, and if you influence somebody else, yeah, perhaps in 5 years, you'll be amazed of where this community is at with all these small farms. And so that's always been kind of my why. And
So a small, local, decentralized food production and distribution system and retailing system.
Yes.
It's got to be something that is desirable for any community in the world.
I agree. And you see with the breweries, that's the best example. It's like 15 years ago, 20 years ago, you'd have a few big beer companies that own all the shelves everywhere. Now there's like here, it's like you can't find, if all the beers are from microbreweries from the area, like all these old beers, the Molsons, you can't even find them. They're not visible anymore. And, you know, bakeries, charcuteries, wine, this is life. You know, eating is a big part of, it's like the culture, you know.
So let me challenge you now.
Yes, please do. Right? Challenge me.
So I know of one wonderful farm, and they have spawned so many farms.
Mm.
They're graduates, the people who have come and worked, and they really teach them, and they go out, and their main model is a CSA.
Yeah.
And a big CSA, and they're you know, every kind of, you know, meat, milk, eggs, you know, vegetables.
A complete diet CSA. Yeah.
Beautiful. And now they're surrounded by kind of complete diet CSAs.
Mm.
And, you know, one partner in the couple is a little bit anxious because
it's competing with them.
It's now they're competing, you know, with their children.
Yeah.
And it's fine. The world has competition. But I'm just curious, in your model, one of the things that I have seen is that some people believe that the CSAs are ultimately limited, that it's a fantastic thing when it happens, but there seems to be a tipping point. And beyond that, people just, a certain number of people, most people, will go to the store to get their food, not to the CSA, not to the farm stand. And so the question is, can we get our food in the store? And I think that you have a different model.
I'm not saying that I have the correct answer about this. This is just my perspective, but I really believe in getting people out of the supermarkets. That's what I believe in. And I think that I don't think small farms like this one can compete with big ag, with big marketing, with all the resources that bigger farms have. Like, we just can't. So what we can compete with is meeting people every week and the direct to consumer relationship. And so that's...
And the quality of the food.
And the quality. The quality, I think you can have quality on a larger scale. I think that's possible. If it was done right, I think that's possible. But meeting the farmer, connecting, I think that's something that's unique to what we do.
Okay. I'm going to challenge you. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I don't think you can have that kind of quality on a large scale.
I've never seen it.
That's right.
I've never seen it.
It seems like it should be possible.
Yeah.
To do something big, but the truth is, when things become big, they change.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was talking to you about Dan Barber's bread.
Yeah.
And when I said, why doesn't Whole Foods have this bread? And it's because they can't. The whole system that made that bread taste so good is a very...
Human
scale.
Yeah, human scale.
Of judgment and feel for the whole process. I think that's so interesting. Intention.
Like the intentions that are put into these things. And that's why I relate now agriculture to culture, because who's feeding you, and what's the end game for that person? If that person's end game is to feed his community with healthy bread or healthy food I think that's a noble reason why you'd want to buy there. And I think that we're going to shift towards more of that. So that's why I see that, you know, having all these small farms, eventually they contaminate other people to that kind of lifestyle, this way of seeing things. And that's what I've seen here. If we're all doing CSA, then that's a problem. If, you know, I'm doing a farm-to-table restaurant now, and then I'm servicing this there, and then I'm buying from other growers also, and then this other farm is doing the farmer's market in Frelisburg, and that other farm is doing, you know, the nearby kindergarten, you know, there's room for everyone to do stuff. But if we're all doing the exact same model, if we're all lining up Saturday morning at the same farmer's market for a town of 400, it's not going to work. And we have Montreal, it's an hour from here, which also makes a difference.
It's a huge market.
Yeah, Montreal is like 3 million.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's not a cookie cutter, but I do think that what we talked about, that intention and that And that's what was there in Europe before. Like, you'd had that people would know fine food and they would go to fine food. And that was the ethos. You know, the terroir. That's terroir. And I think here we're slowly creating this in my community. It's not perfect, but I like to think that this is happening and evolving.
You know, our symposium this year is called Break 'em Up.
Okay.
And it's about challenging the monopolies that run the world.
Yes.
And they absolutely run our food system.
They do.
And it's not just the farm monopolies, it's the distribution monopolies, the processor monopolies, and the retail monopolies. Mm. And in each case, they're going to be fewer and fewer companies that control more and more of everything.
Yeah.
I quote this a lot, but it's an important thing. I asked Michael Pollan in one of my interviews with him, and it was the 15th year anniversary of The Omnivore's Dilemma, which was an incredible book.
A beacon. Things changed.
You know, it really changed people's minds, and they started to think differently. And I said, Michael, I'm genuinely confused about this. In the 15 years since The Omnivore's Dilemma, do you think that the food system has gotten better or worse? Because I see both.
Yeah.
And his answer really clarified it for me. He said, well, I think people's understanding has gotten much better and more sophisticated. And now he was teaching at Harvard that term. He said, I have students here who are asking deep questions about our food system. And he said, 15 years ago, there were no students at Harvard asking deep questions about the food system. And one of them actually ended up coming to work on my farm when she graduated from Harvard, because she asked me a question on his, you know, reference about regenerative agriculture. And we got into a great conversation. He said, but the actual food system is getting worse. And you know, that's what I see. I see that there's more glyphosate used in the world now than there was 15 years ago.
Yep.
And everything is more centralized once you get past this farm to fork movement. Now, maybe the farm to fork movement just in and of itself will threaten that. I get it. But I also have a feeling that we need to challenge the monopolies, that's where we have to go and act on a citizen level to say, that's not the country we want to live in. That's not the world we want to live in. What do you think about that?
Yes, I think putting light on these issues, having people understand, just like you're a good example, like you and the work of the Real Organic Project, like exposing the fact that the USDA wanted to make it possible to have a hydroponic farm being certified. Like, this is something that we need to know and we need to address. And as a community, we need to come together on a higher level. Like, each person doing his own farming doesn't solve that problem. So I see and I understand the need to come together on certain things. It's not the area where I feel that I have a lot of power myself. Like, I've tried to build a community that's really broad, but I don't want to own it and I don't want to be the spokesman of that community. It's like, it's everyone's kind of, it's an organic thing. And that's where personally I struggle with all of this, because I just don't know how to have change on that macro level, on these big issues. And I think that some of these issues, and that's really personal, and I'm not saying that there's some truth to this, but a lot of these issues has to do with, you know, is there a social system? Is there, like, we have free education here in Canada. That changes the landscape. Like, everyone has access to good education.
So, right through college.
Through college.
Yeah.
Everyone has, it's free kindergarten. It's free healthcare. And I don't want to mix topics. That's not what I want to do. But it's like, perhaps if we fix some of these things, the other things will get better.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of ignorance. And that's how we're fed what we're fed. You know? Could it be that less ignorance in a way, or more education on these things, would have people make better choices and so have less of a market for this crappy food? Like, these are the things that I'm thinking myself. I'm like, you know, do people really have enough headspace to think about the food system at all? Or they're just being fed, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound elitist. That's not what I'm saying. It's like, we should have all the people thinking about these things. We should have education at the lower levels and high schools and preschools, and we should have people understanding the importance of a soil and gardening and the environment and all of this. Just, this is what... Anyway.
No, I'm kind of sidetracking the question. No, it's not sidetracked. It's not sidetracked, Jam. These are the issues, and we all feel a lack of power in the face of these huge forces.
Yes.
When the USDA took over organic certification from groups like Vermont Organic Farmers, I felt completely powerless.
Yes.
Nobody asked me what I thought about that.
No.
I didn't think it was a good idea.
No.
Right? But it was like, well, what are you going to do? The U.S. government just did this. Now, in retrospect, I don't think that was the critical mistake.
Mm.
I think the truth is, whether the government took it over or not, it wasn't the government that said, we want hydroponic to be called organic, or we want confinement livestock to be called organic. It was corporations that were making money from that. They controlled the government. So we had to look one step further, and they would have done the same if there hadn't been a government control of it. And they do. Look at what's happening to regenerative right now.
Yeah.
And they just are grabbing the word and redefining it in front of our very eyes.
Yeah.
And we were like, wait, I thought it meant, and like, no, it means this. And of course, there's still people going, no, that's not what I mean. God bless them. I consider them part of the real regenerative movement. But, you know, we all have to face this confusion about stuff where we clearly not only feel out of power, we are out of power. Everybody is.
Yeah.
You know, even Tom Vilsack, head of the USDA, is actually powerless, I think, to change the system. There is no one person who is the czar. Everyone is controlled by these forces. But what do we do about it? That's the question.
Yeah, and I think, Dave, this is the second time that we sit together like this, and you bring me on that, because I remember now, a few years ago we did this, and like, I don't have the best answers about that, but I'm certainly looking up to those who are acting, and that's why I'm a part of, let's say, the Real Organic Project, and I'm a part of other groups, because, you know, I'm not thinking about these issues, but they're important to me.
Yeah.
And so I think that opens the discussion about being organized somehow, structured.
Yeah.
And that means there's a level of democracy that in these organizations, or it brings down to community, you know, community coming together in a structured power dynamic way.
Yeah.
And that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
And I believe, like, I'm not the one that's kind of standing on the hill, on my own hill, fighting my own battle. Like, I'm certainly involved socially here in Quebec a lot. But yeah, sometimes it's really feels powerless. It really does.
Yeah. You know, I just gave a talk a week ago at Churchtown, and I talked about this. This is what we were talking about.
Mm.
And I quoted Vincent Stanley, who's a wonderful human being. And he said, a sense of agency is more important than a sense of optimism.
Mm.
And
I like that.
You think about that, because I'm not an optimist. I'm not. I don't think this is going to work out well. And that could be really make you frozen. But I don't feel frozen. And I do have some sense of agency for myself. At least I can choose to do this. I can choose to drive up here to Quebec and talk to my friend JM about these issues.
Yep.
And people will hear this, and they will think about it, and they will come and talk to somebody else, and we just keep
We're evolving.
We're evolving. We're evolving together.
Mm-hmm.
Co-evolution.
No, and I appreciate the fact that you do that. You know, there's... I think we need to rally around something that we can all understand. And that's why part of my slogan has always been, small-scale farming is changing the world. It's like, let's do it. Let's do it together. Let's act like that. Let's represent. And, you know, let's try to substitute the higher forces with different things. But I think culture will play a big role in that.
Yes.
Culture. And that's why I believe, like, that's why I opened a restaurant. Like, when people come here, they not only see that, you know, local food in season is available year-round here in Quebec, they eat it, and they have a good time.
Yes.
And they appreciate the food. And that, for me, I think they leave here, and then they're impactful to others because they're like, yeah, this is great.
That's right.
You know?
Okay, I'm gonna add another one to this, because it's so interesting.
Go, give her.
We're talking about Leah Penniman. I have high regard for Leah. And she was at our first symposium. We had a live conversation. And she was talking to someone whom I respect. And that person was talking about the power of community and of neighborhood and of changing the schools and changing kids' attitudes towards food and, you know, making food for each other, that these kids who had never cooked anything, you know, making some organic food. And I think that's all wonderful. I completely agreed with that speaker. But Leah said something that I thought was also very true. And she said, I don't think that making organic muffins for your neighbor is going to change the injustice.
Yes.
That, yeah, say black people face in our food system.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, true word.
Yeah.
True word.
Yeah.
And so it's not that we shouldn't be making muffins for our neighbors, organic muffins.
Yeah.
We should. That's part of creating a culture of food, a culture of kindness and generosity, a culture of community and connection. But we also have to, I do believe this, and I, you know, this is my question for you, is we also need to connect the community and say, we need to change some laws too.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we somehow see this as an either or choice, but I don't think it is. I think they have to be together.
Yeah. And I've never met Leah Penniman, but I have really, really high respect for her and her work. And I think if I translate what she's saying is that you also need to not think that because you're making muffin, you're part of the solution. Like that's too big of a shortcut. There needs to be more than that, you know? Just like, it needs to be also, your voice needs to be heard on a different level, on bigger issues. It's hard. It's hard. Like the way the political system is organized, like it's really hard. Like I'm still struggling myself with this, how to have impact, how to be part of organizations, which is very complicated. You're part of an organization. It comes with a lot of headaches. It comes with a lot of meetings. Like I'm a farmer. I'm used to just kind of running my thing. I plant, I seed, I harvest, I sell. It's a complete 360. And then when I'm with meetings on task groups, for, you know, policies for agriculture, these are like endless meetings. It's super long. Perhaps I need to grow wiser and have more time for these things and take more time for these things. I don't know. You're certainly influencing me, I can tell you that.
Yeah, I don't know either, Jane. Yeah, we're all trying to figure it out together.
Yeah.
I do say one thing, you know, I when I was young, I became an organic farmer. Mm. We were all activists. That's what we were doing. We were changing the world. We weren't going to protest marches and rallies. I had done that, but I loved it because this was
hands-on,
touching these plants and putting my fingers in the ground. And I was like, well, this is such rewarding work. And I really, you know, in the beginning, we were organizing with NOFA and these conferences where I was the dummy. I would go to this conference and these older, wiser people like Jake Guest, one of my first teachers, and they were giving workshops and I would go and I would learn and I would become a better farmer. And then I got really involved in making a living and raising my kids as we do when you enter farming as an economic arena. It's a tough arena.
It is.
We know that.
It is.
You know, it's like if you
need to be dedicated.
Yeah. If you just want to make some money, become a lawyer or something because this is a tough one. So it's fine. It has its own wonderful things, but we need to learn every trick in the book to make a living. But I stopped going to those conferences. I just worked all the time. And if I wasn't working, I was with my family who suffered my absence because I worked a lot.
Yeah.
As do most farmers.
Yes.
And, you know, we all do, or I did. And when I started to become engaged, and I just became engaged because what the USDA was doing was so outrageous.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh my God.
You felt obliged.
I felt obliged because I actually knew more about it than most people of what they were doing. And I thought, you know, I made a mistake. I should have kept a little more engagement with the social actions, with the political actions of what we were doing. I don't have judgment. I don't have that kind of remorse about my choices, but if I had it to do over again, I would stay a little more connected to that political community.
Perhaps that could be advice that you pass on.
Yeah.
I'll certainly consider that advice because I'm at that point in my farming career where the kids are older and I did kind of, perhaps it's time for me also to be more engaged.
Yeah.
I just like this creating part of it so much.
Yeah.
And it's just like, for me, it's so fun to open the restaurant. And I really like, I enjoy connecting with people and hanging out with them and just, you know, raising their spirit on these things. So I'll see how this translates into.
Yeah. I consider your work to be very politically active.
Yeah.
I think that you're really helping people to actualize something that is really, it's a target that's easily missed. So you're doing great stuff, but that's right. Part of our conversations, I think, need to be, you know, why is it that, I don't know how it is in Canada. In the US, I mean, I've literally seen three major clients, customers of our tomatoes now are owned by one Dutch multinational.
Yeah.
Ahold USA.
Yeah.
Right? And terrible. Used to be Stop and Shop and Hannaford's and Fresh Direct and Giant, all owned by one now. And of course, you know, Whole Foods owned by Amazon, Kroger's and Albertsons merged. And that's just the retail.
Yeah.
The same thing's happening in production, same thing's happening in distribution. Now there's two major distributors for organic food. And I know that you're working on the underground, Rebel Alliance.
Yeah, like I feel that organic has been co-opted.
Yeah.
Like I still use the word, I still feel the word, I still am part of it, but I just see the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
And I don't think that another word can replace that. I don't think it's regenerative. I think it's connecting people to the local food system. That's what I think. Then, yeah.
Sounds good, JM. Okay, it sounds good. I think you're doing God's work.
Oh la la.
So, last thoughts before we go?
Yeah, one thing that really scares me and disempowers me a lot is when I'm now conferences, not the small scale farming conferences, but the conferences where I'm sitting at for policy at everything's about the future of farming being hydroponic towers, mechanized. It feels that we're really backward with these small scale farms. Like and having lights now to grow in the winter, but these low energy LED lights. Technology is always pushing to be part of this. And I just don't know if I'll be able to cope with, I think I'm going to just end up being an old kind of style farmer, because it's going pretty fast with technology. And I'm not sharing that optimism for having technology clean my beds,
Right.
And that's what's being advocated more and more, because they say there's a shortage of labor.
Right.
So, our governments here, they're investing a lot in technology.
In order to replace labor with machines.
Yeah. And I just feel that's where we lose the intention.
Yeah.
And that's where, we become obsolete. And I don't feel good with that. I don't want to become obsolete. My wife totally doesn't want to become obsolete, and she's not a tech savvy person. And so sometimes I'm really scared by this, and I just feel, I don't feel I have the upper hand on that story,
Yeah, let me ask you a question. This one that I've puzzled about. So when you look at fast food culture, there Alice Waters has beautifully laid out these kind of attributes of cheap, uniform, replicable. Right. And one of them is efficient.
Yeah.
And as you said earlier, it's your North Star.
Yep.
And for me too,
yep.
And I thought, well, how do I make sense of that any farmer I know who's a commercial farmer on whatever scale is really focused on being super efficient. And yet I see that there's some truth in what Alice said, that somehow it's become like a little god. And it seems like there's a difference in what we might mean by efficiency and what McDonald's might mean by efficiency. Do you have any words for that?
Yeah, thinking out loud now that we're discussing this, I think there perhaps the next barrier for small scale farming is having appropriate technology for our scale of farming. Affordable, appropriate technology. Now that I think about it, that could be super positive, because, having here mechanized roll-ups is certainly better than not having the mechanized roll-ups, and having, a controller that manages the airflow, the temperature. That's definitely a benefit for me.
And the BCS with a rotary plow.
Yeah, and if there was a small little robot that would come and hand cultivate everything, if it's like a couple thousand dollars, why not? But I think this feeling that I have, a lot of craftsmen feel it in their own line of trade. Having AI come in, having technology, robotics. So I think this uneasiness that I have is pretty shared across the board.
Yeah, we're all uneasy.
Yeah, is this a real? Is this even real? What people are seeing? Is this fake JM?
Yeah. I know.
See.
And we can't tell.
Talking about being a supporter for Donald Trump all these years,
Right. 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 No, it's. The rate of change is so rapid now that we're all sort of stunned at trying to digest what's going on. I'm looking at your ground and you're talking about cultivating. So let me ask another question. Tillage and no-till.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of thoughts about it, but I'm curious about your thoughts. You're a very intensive market gardener.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me just leave it at that. What are your thoughts about that? No-till has become a bit of a religion in our time, often by non-farmers, but I'm just curious what you think.
Well, I agree with that. It has become very ideological, often by people that are not farmers. I've seen a great no-till farm just last week. I was in Maine, Frit Farm, Daniel May. It's very impressive, Very impressive farm. I think it's a different style. You know, burying your beds with compost all the time or just with organic matter. It's a different style than cultivating and...
Was that what May's farm was? Really heavy compost?
Yeah, compost, but not really compost now. It's more like it's, you know, compost from leaves. So it doesn't have a lot of NPK. It's not high nitrogen. It's just like, you know, brown-black mulch.
Yeah.
Very beautiful farm, very beautiful vegetables. He has, you know, a lot of taste in the aesthetics of the farm. I think it's a different style. Which one produces the higher quality of vegetables? That could be an interesting question. Which one takes more work? That's certainly a very interesting question. Which one has a better bottom line if you compare two kind of systems? I think these are questions that are interesting. And I think that overhyping no-till for me doesn't make any sense at all. Like some tillage, like you said, is great. I use a broad fork here. I think it's a great tool. I've seen so many farms where they think about no-till and then they're saying, well, we don't want to use the broad fork. And it's like, they can't get the broad fork into the ground. It's like, well, if you can't broad fork, then you need to broad fork. Like, don't oversimplify it.
Broad fork like a grill, you know?
Yeah. It's like, if you're having a hard time getting metal tines into the soil, don't think that no-till is great. Like, these vegetables, they need deep rooting systems. That's the key to the biointensive methods that we use. And so nuances.
And they need oxygen to the roots.
They need that. And, you know, cultivating, in my opinion, is still a great way to achieve both. Keeping the beds clean, but bringing oxygen into the soil, spending time with the plants. So I don't know if I'm turning around the thing, but I'm definitely, you know, I'm not, I think it's interesting.
Yeah.
But I certainly, that's not what I want to do here. And there's a reason why that's not what I do.
And why is that?
Well, because I just think this is more efficient in my time.
Yeah.
And I do produce high quality vegetables. And I think that just like, I don't want my game plan to be spreading, you know, move soil around. That's not why I farm.
Yeah.
That's not what I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a lot of soil to move around all the time. It's a lot.
If with a heavy mulching.
Yeah. If you're heavy mulching everything all the time, it's, if you think about it, it's quite the job.
Have you ever been to Brian O'Hara's farm or encountered Brian?
I've read his book.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I've never seen his farm.
It's beautiful. He's a very good farmer.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's so much heavy mulching. I know that Singing Frog and stuff, that's really what they're doing is mulching with compost. But I don't think that's... Brian uses compost for sure. But I think there are other things. I think he's an extraordinary farmer who's developed it very, very, very well. I'm sure that somebody could try that and miss by a mile, by an inch, miss by a mile.
Not talking about Brian or him, but just in general, but what's with the attitude?
With
no-till.
With the no-till attitude? You mean, why is it a religion?
Yeah. Why aren't you just kind of doing this and sharing with your neighbors and then going to farming comp? You know, why such a hype over it? That's where I'm kind of confused. Like I think this came out of courses on soil ecology and then just this having this deep feeling that soils need to be really cared for. But why such an aggressive hype around it? Because that's what I sometimes see. Like, people are very set in their ways.
Yeah.
Like, and it's like, I don't get that part. Like, for me, sharing expertise, sharing knowledge, sharing ways of doing is great. And, you know, perhaps when I was younger, I was pushing the without tractor kind of affair a bit much. So I'm perhaps guilty of that. But anyway.
I think a lot of it grew out of livestock farming and heavy tilled row crops. Mm-hmm. So if you're growing beef or milk cows and you're feeding a whole lot of corn and soybeans, So you're tilling heavily, in the big field operations. It's pretty rough on the soils. It's not what you're doing here.
Yeah.
And clearly depleting the soils. They're more prone to erosion. So no-till looks really good, especially if it means now, if you're doing that livestock, it means you're going all pasture.
Yeah.
You're going all grass.
Yeah, which is great.
It's all great. It's all what we want to do.
Yes.
But I think it became a bit coded for like, well, everything should be that way. And you know, it's complicated.
Mm.
So
nuances.
I think we all should respect it's complicated
Willing to myself debate ideas and go, you know, compare practices. I like that. Actually, yeah. I really like that. And like I say, like this farm that I visited was amazing. It was really epic. And you know, some of the best farmers that I know, they cultivate.
Yeah.
And they're just amazing vegetables, beautiful landscapes, great farms. And so, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I was about to say whatever floats your boat, but I don't want to say that because I think that's part of the confusion.
Yeah.
Like it's not just whatever floats your boat, is what model you're following and then just kind of stick to that. Because if you're trying to pick and choose things from different models, I'm not sure in the end if you're getting somewhere.
Right, right. Like, you know? I've seen some spectacular failures in no-till vegetables.
Yes, oh, for sure.
For sure.
And vegetables like we do here.
Yeah.
Market gardening style.
I don't know if I've ever talked to you about it, but I went and visited these three farms that were part of the Chico State trial on low-till in big field vegetables out in California. And so interesting, JM. And they were doing a beautiful job. These were top farmers. And, you know, maybe my very favorite was Phil Foster, who has 300 acres of just gorgeous, impeccable organic vegetables. And his low-till is he would go through with a disc and a chisel foot and a disc, open it up 10 inches, a little chisel, and close it all in one pass.
Yeah.
He has permanent beds, you know, so he's never messing with the tractor path. And he would flail the cover crop. So he's a big cover cropper.
Yep.
And then
that was his mulch.
That was his mulch.
Yeah.
But that was also his fertility.
Yeah.
He did put in some compost, but he really counted on his green manures to really feed his crop. So he would open up, and so he would end up with a 4-foot bed thereabouts and a 10-inch tilled swath down the middle that he would seed into. And you would think, and everything else was flailed, and it wasn't a weed problem. That wasn't the problem. The problem was his yields were reduced by 10%.
Yeah.
Where he wasn't tilling the full bed. And the other farms had the same issue.
Yeah.
And I said, Phil, why is that? And he says, we don't know for sure, but I think that the cover crop is just sitting on the dry surface. It's very dry in California. And getting the benefit of that breaking down organic matter in the soil with all the wonderful things that happen. I thought, wow, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
These are complicated systems.
And there's room for, you know, universities and ag extension agents kind of doing research on these things.
That's
because,
right.
Because, you know, or farmers sharing their insights.
Yeah.
Like I've planted many, many, many times broccoli in roller crimped cover crops, and I never get the yields.
Yeah.
That if I mow it down, I tarp it, you know, really let the cover crop decompose, and then I put landscape fabric, and then I put my broccolis into landscape fabric, you know, the broccolis are twice the size.
Mm-hmm.
So is no-till better?
You know, right.
That's not what I'm seeing.
That's right. Yeah, I know.
I think I need to hit the road.
Absolutely, JM. Thank you very much.
It was a great time.
Yeah, it was great.
Next time, I'll come and visit.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Real Organic Podcast. Our movement is growing because you're subscribing and sharing these podcasts with your friends. So keep it up and leave us a rating and a review as well. You can find a video of this interview on our newly designed website, realorganicproject.org, or on our YouTube channel. And you can join us every Tuesday for a new episode featuring voices from the organic movement. See you next time.